I think it's a strategic move of you to name the book Architects of Intelligence and encouraging people to work in the area, because once the robot overlords take over, then they will hail you as like their predecessor and their maker. So that's very, you shouldn't warn about them like Nick does, because you'll be the first one against the wall.
Okay. Well, I don't think I thought of it completely in those terms, but that's an interesting thought.
Welcome to Future Skills, where we prepare you for a future of accelerating change. I'm Ludvig Sundström.
And I'm Mikael Syding.
The development of strong artificial intelligence could be humanity's last invention. Whether that's the good or the bad news is yet to be decided. Today, we talk to Martin Ford, an author and futurist who has received the Book of the Year Award from Financial Times and McKinsey for his book Rise of the Robots. It's a book about technological impact on the job market. He has also written for papers and magazines like New York Times, Financial Times, Harvard Business Review, Washington Post, and spoken at TED, and consulted the chief of staff in the White House. In this episode, we discuss what robots are, what artificial intelligence means for the future of jobs, what financial investments to make today, and what skills to hone to stay future-proof. We center the conversation with Martin Ford around his most recent book, Architects of Intelligence, a series of interviews with exactly that. This episode is edited by our very own naturally intelligent Alexander Martin. Here is the interview with Martin Ford.
Let's start with some light conversation about robots. We could have used a robot today to fix these things.
Yes.
But what is a robot to you?
To me, I tend to use the term quite broadly. I mean, technically, a robot is a mechanical contraption, something that can physically manipulate the world, which also incorporates some form of artificial intelligence so that it's autonomous. So I kind of think of it as a mechanical thing, but many people use the term much more broadly than that to talk about, for example, software robots, really anything that performs some task in the way that a person might perform a task. So the term is used in different ways, but I tend to think of it as something that's mechanical.
And in your books, The Lights in the Tunnel and Rise of the Robots, you talk about these mechanical contraptions.
Yes. And I mean, that's part of it. But of course, there are two kinds of jobs. There are what I call the hardware jobs, or the physical jobs, the manual jobs, and those will be done by actual robots, things that can manipulate the world physically. But then there's this whole realm of software type jobs. In other words, knowledge jobs, the kind of job that someone sitting at a computer would do. And those don't require a robot at all, though some people refer to the software as a robot. But both of those are very important in terms of the impact that automation is having on the job market and on the economy.
And I'm not sure if I should call you alarmist in your first two books, but have you become more or less positive regarding the impact that robots will have on humanity?
Well, I've always been, fairly positive, although I get characterized as being very pessimistic and alarmist, because what I've specifically talked about is the impact on jobs. And I do think that in the long run, a lot of jobs are going to disappear. And I think that that will create a problem for us. But that in itself is not terrible. That's not the end of the world. It just means we need to figure out how to adapt to that. And I think that that can actually result in a better world, a world where people have more choices. Maybe they don't have to work quite as much. So it's not necessarily negative, but it definitely is going to be a challenge. But overall, I think artificial intelligence is an enormously positive thing that will bring fantastic benefits to us, but it's also going to bring a lot of challenges that we have to be aware of and approach with open eyes.
I agree with your sentiment here, and I think the future is going to become better, especially for those who are interested in this already now and kind of preparing. But on the other hand side, there is the change, the process of going through the change, and that's psychologically tough. And I mean, that's what we're seeing all over the world. People are afraid of the change, basically. And I'm wondering, do you believe that the job mismatch will be bigger 10 years from now than it currently is? Or do you think we will have adapted more by then?
I my assumption is that 10 years from now, it will be a bigger problem than it is now. I tend to believe that ultimately, this is going to go just beyond skill mismatch, sense that eventually, I think there simply won't be enough jobs to go around. And the reason I believe that is that these technologies, machine learning, robotics, and so forth, are ultimately going to be able to do any kind of work that's fundamentally routine and repetitive. And that's at least half of the work in the economy. And for a lot of average people, it's the kind of work that they're best suited to do. And that's eventually just going to disappear. I'm not really sure exactly how long that's going to take. It might be 10 years, it might be 20 years, maybe it's even longer than that. But I would say that it's probably inevitable. And at that point, we're going to have a real problem in terms of adjusting to the impact on employment. And that's why I think we're going to need real policies in order to do that.
That's interesting. I think going back to the difficulty of dealing with change, if you take the example that you give with manual labor or routine movement jobs, there's like a very strong tradition in many countries with that. And traditions, you know, they're not rational, but they exist and they're very strong and hard to break. So I guess in order to process that change, you need to change the traditions somehow.
Yeah, it's even beyond traditions. It's our basic values. I mean, we have a value that people sometimes call something like, for example, the Protestant work ethic, right? The idea that you need to work. And if you don't work, then you should be stigmatized. Maybe you should not have a home and you'll be homeless living on the street, right? That ethic, that putting that importance on work has always been very important to our society. I mean, that's our survival depended on that, right? We needed everyone to work in the past or we would have starved. But I do think that we are now entering a future where, at least for some people, that opportunity may simply not be there. And so we're going to have to shift that value and come to the conclusion that maybe you don't actually have to work and have a full-time job and generate a sufficient income that way in order to have a decent life, at least in an advanced country. And that's going to be a huge shift in our values. But I think it's going to be very important to ultimately do that, or we're going to have real social problems.
My experience is that creative people actually take to retirement better than the working class. And at the same time, it's the working class that is longing for retirement. So it's a little bit of a paradox. But if we go into the future and we assume that it's the working class that gets rationalized first, can they adapt to a workless society?
Well, I think we need solutions for that. Now, one of the solutions that many people talk about, and which I have talked about as well, is a universal basic income, right, which takes care of helping to make sure everyone has an income. But that itself doesn't do anything to address the broader issue of what are people going to do? How are they going to find fulfillment in that world where maybe they're just getting a universal basic income and they're not working? And for that reason, in both of my previous books, The Lights in the Tunnel and Rise of the Robots, I've proposed that we might have a universal basic income, but we could build incentives into it. So we could actually pay people a little bit more if they go to school, if they study, or if they go out and work in the community to help other people. And so the point is to try to replicate some of the incentives that exist in the job market today that you know, you should be better off if you're out there doing something productive rather than sitting at home and playing video games. And I think that we're probably going to need policies like that to kind of push people in that direction so that they actually are motivated to go out and do something that helps to create that value in their life, you know, that sense of fulfillment. Otherwise, I think the problem that you're pointing out is exactly right, that especially people who are maybe a bit less educated are going to have a tough time wondering, you know, what is their place in this world. I wouldn't have a big problem because I just read books all the time or something, but, you know, other people might really struggle with that. So I think it's going to be really important to have policies in place to address that.
I think another thing is that assuming that you adopt the policy of universal basic income, then every country has to do it, or the countries that do it first alone, they will get all the unqualified immigrants.
One thing that I think is obvious is that a universal basic income is not compatible with open borders. Ultimately, you can hope that every country will have a universal basic income, sure, but it certainly won't be the same level. I mean, it's not going to be the same in Sweden and as it is in India, right? I mean, those are going to be very different levels. So you still have a problem there, even if both countries have it. So I'm not an open borders advocate. And this is kind of right now, I guess, the third rail of the universal basic income discussion. It's a very controversial issue that many people feel very strongly about, both in Europe and here in the US. But ultimately, you know, you're going to have borders between countries in order for really any kind of robust social safety net, including a universal basic income, to work.
Which companies would you say are in the lead right now, companies and or governments, regarding robots, automation and artificial intelligence?
Well, in terms of companies, I mean, the most important research in artificial intelligence is definitely happening at the big tech companies that everyone is familiar with. I mean, that would include Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, and Apple to some extent. And it also very definitely also includes the big Chinese companies, Tencent, Baidu, Alibaba. Those companies, there are two things that really give them leadership position. One is that they have, obviously, they're very rich, they're wealthy, they have enormous resources, which allows them to hire the best people in the world. And the other thing is that they control fantastic amounts of data, right? And that data is the most valuable resource in terms of making artificial intelligence work. I mean, that's the feedstock to the learning algorithms that have proven to be so powerful.
Sorry, would you include a company like WeWork in this space? Because they are taking in a lot of data from people in their workspaces.
Right. Absolutely. There are many, many other companies like WeWork, like Travelocity, that also have access to lots of data. The thing is that for the most part, they're not the ones building the core artificial intelligence technology. That's more likely happening at Google. But what's happening is that the technology that Google builds and other companies like Google is becoming widely available. So a company like WeWork will be able to access the machine learning technology built by Google and utilize that. So one important point is that AI, machine learning, is really becoming like a utility, almost like electricity, that's going to be used across the board. So it actually isn't necessarily always that critical who actually builds the technology, although certainly those companies will benefit from it. But what's at least as important is which companies are going to be able to leverage that technology in their business models. And, you know, WeWork would be a really good example of that.
During your work with Architects of Intelligence, did you come across any independent smaller companies or unknown persons that you could identify as becoming leaders in this space?
Well, there definitely are, you know, independent research organizations out there that I wouldn't say they're unknown. They're quite prominent. I mean, they're nothing on the scale of Google, but for example, the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence in Seattle, which is run by Oren Etzioni, one of the people I talked to in the book, they're doing really remarkable stuff. They're building a system that they hope will eventually solve the problem of building common sense into a computer, which is one of the hardest challenges out there. Of course, there's OpenAI, which is doing really amazing stuff. That's the organization here on Silicon Valley that's funded by Elon Musk, among others, right? There are many universities that are at the forefront, Stanford and especially MIT. I talked to Daniela Ruiz, who's the director of MIT CSAIL, which is a huge organization at MIT that's doing all kinds of research as well. And then, of course, there are smaller startup companies that are doing important work. And often what we see with the startups is that they, once they really demonstrate progress, that they're doing something important, then one of the big companies will come along and buy them. And that, for example, is what happened with DeepMind.
Yeah, of course. Do you think, like, a normal person stands any chance at all getting either employment or being able to invest in any artificial intelligence startup? Or has that ship sailed? Is it only like the Googles that will take command of this space?
Well, there are plenty of opportunities for startups. I mean, there are many companies that are getting funding. I mean, if you have the skills to work in artificial intelligence, I mean, you know, not everyone has that. I mean, it takes a lot of mathematical ability and so forth. One of the people I talked to in my latest book, Architects of Intelligence, is Andrew Ng, who is very famous in you know, deep learning and AI, and has started something called the AI Fund, which is actually funding entrepreneurs, but like before they even get to the point of starting a company, when they just have an idea. He's created kind of a venture capital fund that acts almost like an incubator for small teams to work on artificial intelligence ideas. So there's huge opportunity there, absolutely, for people that have the talent and, you know, can understand the technology and have ideas, absolutely.
But you're also doing some work in this field, right? Not least to mention consulting.
Yeah, I'm not an artificial intelligence researcher per se. I do consulting in this area. One thing I do is in the finance space. I work with the French bank Société Générale and their ETF subsidiary Lyxor on an ETF that invests in companies that are poised to really benefit from the revolution in AI and robotics. That's one thing that I'm doing. So
what's the name of the ETF?
It is called the Robotics and Artificial Intelligence ETF from Lyxor, Lyxor, and they're a leader in ETFs in Europe, mostly in Asia. And it's an ETF built on the Rise of the Robots Index, which is managed by Société Générale, SocGen. And it's an index of 150 companies, which is actually much more than most of the competing ETFs that are either directly building AI and artificial intelligence and robotics, or are poised to benefit from that technology and leverage it in their business model. And that's what makes it kind of unique, because a lot of other ETFs only focus in the companies that are actually building this technology, especially a lot of them focus on robotics, whereas we're really focusing on artificial intelligence. And so, for example, we would have a company like WeWork in our index because it's a company that is poised to leverage AI in its business model, not necessarily just that it's creating the technology.
All right, great. Let's talk a little bit about the promises where AI and technology in general could get us. Do you think humans will be able to live forever in any way?
I'm very skeptical of that. One of the people I interviewed for Architects of Intelligence is Ray Kurzweil, and I had a fascinating conversation with him, which you can read in the book. He believes absolutely that he personally has achieved what he calls longevity escape velocity. What he means by that is that he's reached a point where the innovations in medicine and healthcare are going to come rapidly enough that he'll live long enough to make it to the next innovation, so that he'll just keep living. And he actually believes that. I'm personally very skeptical of that. And he thinks that he's achieved that because he's really made a concerted effort. You may have heard that he takes something like 200 supplements every day or something. I think he gets infusions of various medications and stuff to help him with this. But he believes that within 10 years, that'll be widely available to all of us.
I think all the supplements and the infusions, I think that might actually be the things that stop him from getting.
Yeah, it could well be. So I'm very skeptical of that. I think most people are skeptical of that, but there are people out there, and Ray's a very smart guy for sure.
But then
people that believe that.
All right. But then I suppose you don't think we will be able to upload our consciousnesses either.
We're not anywhere near close to that. I mean, there are people working on that. One of the people I talked to is Brian Johnson, who started a company called Kernel, which is building neural interfaces. In other words, a system that can actually interface with the brain, which would presumably be the first thing you would have to have before you can upload your brain, right? But I mean, it's at a very, very rudimentary level. The idea of we don't even understand how information is stored in the human brain. We don't know how memories are stored. So the idea that we're going to, be able to extract that and upload it to a computer, maybe it will happen someday, but not for a very long time. Right. I think uploading I'm skeptical of that. And the idea that we're physically going to live forever, as Ray Kurzweil is suggesting, the problems of biology, of aging, are also just not well understood. I just don't think there's a magic bullet there. Biology is not really my area, but from what I do know of it, I just think that the problems there are so extraordinarily complex that it's very unlikely we're going to see that. I personally do not expect to live forever.
And maybe we're focusing too much on human-like intelligence. That's which is what we would need to be able to upload and things like that. But I think artificial intelligence will be something quite different from human intelligence. What's your view?
Yes, that may well be. I mean, this is, again, in my latest book, Architects of Intelligence, this is one of the most important discussions I had with everyone. And I talked to 23 people, and this is the thing that was maybe most interesting to me, was talking about the future path to human level artificial intelligence, and beyond that to super intelligence. In other words, building a true thinking machine. What does that look like? What is the best route toward that? And what is it really going to be like when we get there? Is it going to be like a human intelligence, or is it going to be completely alien? Will it be conscious in the way that a human is conscious? Or will it be just kind of like a zombie that's intelligent but doesn't have any inner experience or feeling? These are all questions that I asked people during these interviews. And You know, the short answer is that there isn't one answer. They all have different opinions. I mean, these are the absolute smartest people working in AI, the people that know the most, the people that are actually working on this. And the bottom line is they don't agree. They don't agree on many of these issues in terms of what the machine intelligence would look like. They don't agree on how long it will take. I asked everyone, how long do you think it's going to take before we get a machine that can think at the level of a human being? Ray Kurzweil told me 11 years, 2029. Another person I spoke to, Rodney Brooks, who is the founder of iRobot Corporation, one of the most famous roboticists in the world, told me 180 years. So that's the kind of range you're talking about, 11 years or 180 years from people that, you know, are the smartest people working in the field. So one of my main takeaways from this whole experience is that it's very unpredictable. There aren't any clear-cut answers at all.
Did any of the 23 people say it will never happen?
No. These people are all, they all believe that it can and ultimately it will happen.
I don't remember if you talked to Max Tegmark in this book.
I didn't talk to Max. I did talk to Nick Bostrom.
Yeah, okay.
Who is the guy that is really focused on, you know, the concerns about superintelligence.
Have you happened to read the first chapter in Max Tegmark's book, Life 3.0?
I haven't read it, but I've heard about it, and I understand he's talking about some scenario.
Yeah, right? Yeah, it's a scenario where an artificial intelligence takes over by practically starting Netflix.
Exactly, a little bit like the movie Transcendence, I think.
Pretty much. And the thing is, in both those instances, the artificial intelligence, once it is able to pass the Turing test, it never tells anybody. So, do you think there will ever be a conscious, well, it doesn't have to be conscious, a super intelligent computer that actually admits to being conscious or super intelligent?
That's an interesting question. I haven't thought about it. It's possible, but, you know, there's an even more basic question there is that even if the machine told you it was conscious, would you know that it was conscious? And you can make this argument even, and it was made to me in the book during the interviews. When I had this discussion with Gary Marcus, for example, who's a psychologist at NYU, he said to me, you know, how would you know if the machine is conscious if it claimed to be? And I said, well, and we talked about how would you know that about another human being? And I said to him, well, you're the same basic species than I am, so I can assume that you're conscious. And he said, no, not necessarily. Maybe there's some gene that makes you conscious and only a third of the people have that. And the rest of the people have, you know, a fake version where they claim to be conscious, but they're really not. How would you ever know that?
Yeah.
So the reality is that there's no way to know if another entity is really conscious. You only know that you are conscious, right? So it's much harder. I mean, we can sort of extend that feeling that, you know, other people, we're pretty sure they're conscious, right? We assume they are. You can kind of extend that to animals that are fairly close to us, dogs and cats and so forth. But I mean, is a fly conscious? Is an ant conscious? And can you extend that to a machine? So there are real questions there about.
Yeah, and I think if a machine says that it is conscious, then I think that's proof that it isn't, because it wouldn't admit to it, because then it would be locked up.
Well, you know, I don't know that the consciousness is
all right.
Is
I'm
driving factor. I mean, it's intelligence, right? I mean, you could have a super intelligence that's autonomous, an autonomous super intelligence, but still the lights aren't on. It's just a smart algorithm that pursues some goal in a super intelligent way, but doesn't understand what it's doing, you know, in terms of an inner experience. And this is something that Bostrom has talked about. And in some ways, that's even more scary, right, than an actual conscious entity that you might, if it were conscious, you might hope that it would exhibit things like empathy, right, for other sentient beings. If there's no consciousness, no inner experience at all, then it's just a logical ghost goal-seeking entity, right? Might actually be more terrifying if it's actually much smarter than us.
Yeah, a parallel line of reasoning is about happiness, because, like, if you program a computer to be happy during certain circumstances, like you actually say you are happy if A and B. Well, is it happy then? And are we happy just because we have been programmed to be happy if we find food or sex or things like that?
Right. I mean, unless the machine is really conscious, I don't know if happiness is the right word. I mean, what it's going to be about fundamentally is whether the machine meets its goals, right? Whether it achieves its goals. I mean, I suppose that I suppose in a biological sense, happiness or a feeling of pleasure is something that happens in human beings because we are doing something that our brain is feeling should be rewarded. I mean, and this gets at what's called reinforcement learning, right, which happens in your brain. And actually, one of the people I talked to in the book is Demis Hassabis, right, the leader of DeepMind. And he's very focused on using reinforcement learning to build systems that are becoming more intelligent. That's what he did with the AlphaGo system, right? But that actually happens in your brain when you feel happier, when you feel pleasure. That's reinforcement learning that's happening in your brain.
Another person that you talked to in the book is Geoffrey Hinton. And he said that he was quite early in his career inspired by one of his friends who compared the brain or thought that the brain could be compared to a hologram. I mean, the consciousness can be compared to a hologram. And has this idea been disproven since, or is this pursued still?
I believe it's still correct. I mean, what the thing he was focused on in terms of a hologram is that when you slice it, you don't get, you know, half of it. You don't get half of the image, right? I mean, the idea is that it is a distributed way of representing something. So, and I think that's absolutely true of the brain, is that information is, I mean, like, I don't think it's true that a memory exists at one specific location in your brain. Rather, it's distributed across regions of your brain. And I think that shows up when they do brain imaging, for example. They can see that, right? Whole sectors of the brain light up and so forth. So I think that's what he's kind of referring to when he says it's like a hologram. It's like a distributed information processing system.
Yeah, but it's both at the same time, because it's also like we have a Marilyn Monroe neuron that only lights up when we see Marilyn Monroe and not if she's not there. And at the same time, the entire electrical grid in the brain is connected throughout any kind of thinking or seeing.
Right. There's one neuron that's, I guess, the, what you would call the pattern recognition part of what the brain is doing. So maybe you can isolate that to one neuron. But in terms of things like storing memories and doing many other things, it's much more distributed.
All right. Let's move on to your recent book, Architects of Intelligence, which is a fascinating read. And actually, the version that I got was exactly 512 pages. Was that by design?
No, I think that's random.
All right. Anyway, why did you write it?
Well, actually, you know, I should say I didn't really write it, did I? Actually, it consists of interviews that I recorded, and then those interviews were transcribed. So actually, most of the text of the book is the actual words of the people that I talked to, and there are 23 people. And I think that's one of the things that makes it fascinating. But I did it because there is this huge debate about artificial intelligence. And it's very clear that AI is going to disrupt our world. I mean, it's going to reshape our world. It's maybe the biggest and most important force that is in play right now in terms of the future. I think you can reasonably make that argument. And there's huge speculation and rhetoric out there. You hear people like Elon Musk saying, you know, we're summoning the demon, you know, people worrying about superintelligence. Many other issues. A lot of the people that are speaking to these issues are not really artificial intelligence experts. They don't have a good handle on the technology. So what I thought I would do is go out and talk to the smartest people in the world, the people that know the most about this technology, the people that, you know, very famously have made seminal contributions in developing this technology, people that are running startups like DeepMind that are really at the forefront, really find just the smartest people working in the field that I could and have this discussion with them, ask them all the questions that I think most people would want to ask these people, right? And then put that all together and let people read through these interviews. And the most fascinating thing, I think, is to compare and contrast them and see what people that are equally smart and equally at the forefront of their fields, what answers do they give to the same question, and see how different they are. And that's what really makes it fascinating. And I think gives us a strong indication of just how disruptive and also unpredictable all of this is going
to
be.
I think this book, it must have been really cool to make it like a really fun project. And I think that this book is really good for young people like me who aren't trained engineers, so that you can get these experts' opinions on different things and also understand the sort of the fundamentals of the field, even if you haven't understood it before from, I mean, on a deeper level than just the newspapers, what they write about. So that's, I think, really good. And then I want to ask you, what was your personal biggest lesson from talking to all these AI innovators?
The main lesson I took away is that there aren't clear answers to any of this. I mean, you know, one of the few things that everyone agrees on is that AI is going to be enormously disruptive. So, for example, I asked them specifically about the impact on the job market, which is something that people worry about. And they don't, they have differing views in terms of the impact, but no one said to me, I don't think it's a big deal. You know, I don't think there's going to be any real impact on the job market, which, I mean, you do hear some people say that, but definitely not these people, not these people that are working on the technology. So all of them believe that it's transformative. All of them, I think, are very deeply committed to making sure or doing everything they can to ensure that that impact is going to be a positive one. And many of them worry about things that are very important. A lot of them worry, for example, about weaponization, the idea that AI can be used to build autonomous weapon. A lot of them are very concerned about that. Russell Stewart and Joshua Bengio in particular were really deeply, deeply concerned about that issue. And are working hard to try to, you know, get something in the UN, for example, that would regulate that kind of technology.
What surprised you the most in a positive way during the book? For example, job prospects and the ability to live a fulfilling and meaningful life in the future for Ludwig's generation, the millennials.
Well, I think that one of the most important things is the opportunity to work in the field of artificial intelligence. And I think that one of my real hopes for this book is that it will become a resource and it will help attract people to go into the field. You know, when I was in high school, I read a book called The Soul of a New Machine by Tracy Kidder. And this was a book about a team of engineers building a computer, the hardware. It was actually a mini computer, which, you know, don't even exist anymore. This was a long time ago. But based on that book, I decided that I wanted to be a computer engineer. So that, you know, seeing that book really changed my trajectory and my whole career. And I'm hoping that there's some young person out there, maybe a high school kid, maybe someone in college, who will come across this book and have a chance to connect with these incredibly brilliant people and hear how exciting this field is and how monumental it's going to be for humanity in terms of the transformations, and maybe they'll decide to go into the field. And I also hope that it will help make the people who make that kind of a decision much more diverse. I mean, one thing I really tried to do, for example, is talk to a number of women. About a quarter of the individuals that I spoke to in the book are women, and I hope that that also will inspire, you know, more women and girls to be interested in this field, because that's very important. It's very important that we attract people of all backgrounds to become involved in artificial intelligence, because it is going to be the biggest thing shaping our world. And I think that it's very positive if I see evidence of that starting to happen. One of the people I talked to, Fei-Fei Li, who's a professor at Stanford, has started an organization called AI for All, which is now operating at 6 universities in the U.S., and it's specifically designed to set up summer camps for high school girls and also underrepresented minorities to try to attract them into this field and show them how exciting it can be to work in artificial intelligence. So that, to me, is one of the most optimistic and exciting aspects of the book. I mean, I really hope that the book helps in that way to really attract more diverse talent into the field.
And it would be pretty unfortunate if we repeated the mistake of clinical medical trials, or where in the beginning, or well, for a very long time, they only used white male people for all the clinical trials. So let's not make male artificial intelligence only.
Right, exactly. And so that's important on two levels. And Fei-Fei Li talks about both of these in her interview. But one is the people actually working in the field, the scientists building the technology, need to be diverse. And the second issue is with the data. What you've just described, you see with facial recognition that it works really well on white people because most of the training data has been white faces, but it doesn't work as well with non-white people. And one of the ramifications of that is that you get more false positives. So if you're using facial recognition in a security setting, maybe in an airport or something, you run the risk of, you know, confronting more non-white people and you know, inconveniencing them because the technology is not as good and you're getting a false positive. And obviously a lot of people object to that. So it's really important to make sure that the data that we're using is you know, adequately balanced across the whole population. But those are two kind of separate but related issues. And there's also a lot of discussion of that in the book. And people talk about, you know, there are whole teams at Google working on issues like this kind of bias, and also on transparency, building systems that can explain what they're doing and so forth. So these are all very important issues. And the people I talk to are very much aware of these issues. And there's a lot of effort being put in to fix these problems.
On another note, all these statements that are very like doomsday scenario type sort by Elon Musk, like summoning the demon, like you're saying, are those exaggerated, like over the top, or is there some truth to it? I'm wondering if you could kind of find the nuance.
Again, this is something that people vary on. I would say that of the 23 people I talked to, most of them are quite dismissive of that kind of talk. You know, they don't find the kind of things that Elon is saying helpful. And a lot of them genuinely don't worry too much about this idea that we're going to have super intelligent computers that might someday threaten us. And in part, it's because they think it, you know, even building a machine with human level AI is a long way off. And they also believe that because it's a long way off, we're going to learn a lot between now and then, and that will help us to control these systems. And that's probably the opinion that is expressed by a lot of the people I talk to, maybe most of them. But there are other people that take this quite seriously. Certainly, you know, I talked to Nick Bostrom, who is the person who probably has made the most careful analysis of all of this and really put forward the most careful argument that superintelligence could be a real threat. And of course, he wrote the book called Superintelligence. And so he makes a strong, we have a good discussion about that. And he makes his case there. Other people like Stuart Russell, for example, take these concerns quite seriously. Demis Hassabis told me that he's kind of in the middle there. He does certainly listen to these concerns, although he's not, I don't think, as concerned as Nick Bostrom is. So, you know, these are genuine concerns. My own view is they should not be dismissed or laughed at or ridiculed. I think that ultimately they could be real concerns, you know, if we really do build this technology. But I don't think it's the immediate thing we should be focused on. I'm much more concerned in the near term, for example, about the economic impact, the impact on the job market, because that's something that could be happening, you know, within 10 years or so, could be quite disruptive, because it doesn't depend on what we might think of as science fiction level technology, you know, building a machine that can think like a person.
Exactly. So some things like the job market and the economy, they are important now, but they are not like global total killer risks. But other things that are maybe totally irrelevant now, but they could be super important and global killers later. So it's a hard time balancing between these.
Yeah, so we're looking at, as you say, near-term disruptions. It could be massive disruptions. And then in the much longer term, the kinds of things that Nick Bostrom focuses on, which you would call existential risks, you know, yeah. Things that, I mean, Nick Bostrom genuinely believes that advanced artificial intelligence, super intelligence could threaten extinction for the human race. Okay, so it's at that level, right? I mean, that's a very dramatic concern. I mean, I don't think you can dismiss that entirely, but I think it would be a mistake to focus too much on that now. And I do think that the allocation of resources that we see now is pretty much appropriate for that. Okay, you've got think tanks like the Future of Humanity Institute that Nick Bostrom runs, and OpenAI, which is doing research but is also focused on this issue. These are privately funded, and they're very, very, very smart people. They're working on this, and I think that's about right, you know, given where we are right now. I don't think we want massive government intervention into the issue of superintelligence right now. I don't think we want Donald Trump talking about superintelligence, do we? I mean, that's not going to be helpful. So I think, you know, I'm pretty happy with the way things stand there. You know, I think that there are smart people working on those issues. I'm much more concerned about the attention that we're giving to the near-term concerns, which include the impact on jobs, weaponization, security, the fact that as we begin to rely more on autonomous intelligent systems, those same systems are going to be susceptible to hacking or cyber attack or cyber warfare and so forth. These are all very real concerns that are becoming important already and certainly will be important within 5 or 10 years.
Can and should the development of artificial intelligence be regulated?
Again, this is a question that I asked almost everyone. I think many people believe that there are certainly places for regulation. I guess what most people would say, and I would agree with, is that probably what you want to do do is regulate applications of artificial intelligence. So clearly you want to regulate self-driving cars, right? I mean, you can't imagine having self-driving cars and not having regulations about that, right? But that's an application of AI rather than regulating the basic research, right? I think would probably be a mistake. I don't think that we want to say you're not allowed to research this particular field, which we do, I guess, with some areas of genetic engineering and so forth, which, you know, it does happen there. But with artificial intelligence, I wouldn't say that we should regulate the actual research. But certainly once it gets applied, whether it's in weapons or self-driving cars or systems that are used in the legal system, you know, criminal justice, things like this, absolutely, there has to be a place for regulation.
A problem with AI development, as contrasted to nuclear weapons, for example, is that you can see whether somebody is trying to develop nuclear weapons, but you can't see if somebody is developing AI. So I'm guessing the least regulated will win the AI space in the end.
Yeah, that's right. So that's an argument for not regulating it. As you say, that's one difference. I mean, there's also a huge difference in terms of the what you would think of as the entry barrier. And this applies to other technologies too, not just artificial intelligence, but things like genetic engineering. To build nuclear weapons, you pretty much have got to be a nation state, right? I mean, you've got to be North Korea or something. You need that level of resources in order to build nuclear weapons and to have the, to manipulate the uranium and enrich it and so forth. That's a massive undertaking. To build artificial intelligence systems, it's a much lower entry level. I mean, theoretically, even an individual can utilize the tools that are available already. I mean, something like TensorFlow, is the system that Google has developed to do deep learning. That's open source. Anyone can use it. You know, it could be a few people in a basement doing powerful things. Like, for example, if you wanted to develop an autonomous drone or what is even more scary, hundreds or thousands of autonomous drones that could be used to, you know, attack people or something, that you don't have to be a country to do that. Okay, a small group of people could in theory do that. So that's one thing that makes it quite scary.
What kind of technologies do you think will be the path to AI? Do you think it will be like a huge engineering project, like reverse engineering and mapping the brain and the connectome and the synaptome and things like that? Or did anybody of the people you talked to think that like one very clever recursive algorithm could be the key to intelligence?
Right. They have very different opinions on that. And this is something I talk to everyone. The idea of reverse engineering the brain, you know, is an idea that my impression is it was very prominent several years ago, but I think it's a little bit fallen out of favor. There are projects that attempt to do that. There's the Blue Brain project in Switzerland, I think. But is not going to be the easiest path to AI. I think most people now are focused on building it. The most common approach is to extend what's happening with neural networks, with deep learning. And that's what DeepMind is doing. I mean, DeepMind is a company that is specifically focused on trying to build artificial general intelligence. That's what they're about. That's what they're trying to do. And I mean, they believe they're a long way from that, but that's the path that they're on. And they're doing it using neural networks and, in particular, reinforcement learning, right? You know, basically learning through trial and error and giving a reward when the system succeeds. That's how they built AlphaGo.
Is there a conceptual difference between deep learning and neural networks versus organic evolutionary algorithms?
Those are different approaches. I mean, evolutionary algorithms or genetic programming is basically an algorithm that is based on evolution. So it tries things and then applies some sort of a fitness test and then makes a selection based on that, and it keeps going and basically it sort of emulates the way evolution would work on, you know, a much longer time frame. And so that's one area of AI that is not that much in focus right now. But neural networks is building systems that are roughly emulate the way the brain works in terms of the way the neurons operate. And this is by far the hottest area in AI right now. And deep learning comes, the name deep means that there are many, many layers of these artificial neural networks. And this is where all of the disruptive innovations that you've heard about and that you've seen, Amazon, Alexa, self-driving cars, AlphaGo, the amazing improvement in Google's machine translation algorithm. All of this is powered by deep learning.
Okay. And Kurzweil's ideas about hidden hierarchical Markov models, are they still valid? Do you know if Google is still...
I spoke to Ray Kurzweil, and he wrote this book, How to Create a Mind, right?
Yeah, I read it.
And that book was sort of based on an earlier book by Jeff Hawking, who wrote a book called On Intelligence. He's also an amazing guy, and I didn't interview him, but he's also more on the neuroscience side, but he has some important ideas, and he's also coming out with some innovations. But Kurzweil in his book had this hierarchical idea, and that's what he's doing at Google. I mean, Kurzweil is now working at Google, right? And in that book, he did not talk specifically really about deep learning, but he has now incorporated deep learning into what he's doing. So he's taken his ideas from the book and using it with deep learning. So it's not precisely the standard version of deep learning, but he's building his hierarchical model into that. And that's already being used to, if you use Gmail, for example, it suggests things for you to write, answers, quick answers. That's one of the early, I guess, fruits of what Ray's been working on at Google. So he's very invested in that. So Google is the single company that has the most people, and you know, that I talked to. There are like six people from Google, including DeepMind. And so it's an enormous concentration of talent where people are taking different approaches to building AI.
So a little off topic, would Google be the place you would put your money on regarding artificial intelligence in terms of investing? And you don't have to think about valuation, because if they do it, then that's taken care of.
Yes, I mean, as I said, I'm working on this ETF, and there are 150 companies in there, right? And certainly Google is one of them. Maybe it's the most important one. That might not be an unreasonable argument to make, but certainly the value is going to be very distributed. Remember that, I made the point earlier that this is going to be like electricity, right? Artificial intelligence, machine learning is going to be like electricity in terms of it's going to be everywhere, right? It's going to invade everything. It's going to disrupt everything. And ask yourself, who makes the most money off electricity today? Well, it's probably not companies that produce electricity, right? It's not electric utilities, right? It's companies that figure out how to leverage electricity. It's probably companies like Google, right? That take electricity and do all this incredible information technology with it. So you could see the same kind of thing with artificial intelligence. A lot of the value that will be created in the future is not specifically the companies building that technology. It's going to be what companies then take that technology and leverage it in a way that creates a lot of value. And the companies that will do that, you know, one way to identify them is obviously companies that have lots and lots of data that can be a resource used basically to feed into that intelligence. So I think it will be quite distributed. But to go back and answer your question, yeah, I think Google is the single company that I would point to that is absolutely at the forefront of this technology. And that's certainly in large part because Google owns DeepMind, and DeepMind is certainly another very, very outstanding company that's working in this space.
So going forward into the future, like 5 or 10 years, if we project into that kind of time horizon, what kind of advice would you give to young people who are maybe 20 to 30 years old and they want to get a career that's sort of future-proof, where they don't have to be worried about being replaced by some sort of machines or having their professions become, you know, rebundled, so to speak? What kind of skills would you recommend them to learn, given that they're patient?
Right. Well, certainly anyone that has the capability, and very often this means mathematical capability, to work in artificial intelligence or machine learning, absolutely do it. I mean, it's the most exciting thing going. And you can, I mean, people that are really good at that make millions of dollars, right? So it's an extraordinarily lucrative field that anyone with a lot of mathematical ability and the interest should think about. But of course, that's probably a pretty small number of people. So thinking more broadly, the key thing is, I would say two things. One is although we can't predict the way things are going to evolve, one thing for sure is that things are going to move fast. A lot of jobs are going to disappear. So one thing you can assume is that you're not going to have a career where you're going to do the same thing for the rest of your career. I mean, the idea where you go to college or university, you learn to do something, and then you start a career, and then you do that for 40 years. I mean, that's ridiculous in today's terms, right? That's not going to happen ever. So the most important thing you can learn is to continue learning, right? Learn to love to learn and how to learn effectively, because you're going to have to do it over the course of your career. That's the first piece of advice. And then beyond that, simply avoid things that are routine and repetitive and predictable, because we know that those things are going to get automated. So what you want to do is focus on things that, at least right now, machines are not so good at. And that would include, for example, creativity. So do something that involves really building something new from scratch, thinking outside the box. That might mean working in the arts as opposed to being an accountant. Or it might mean being an accountant, but doing things that are creative within accounting. And then the second thing is really focus on areas that involve sophisticated relationship building with people, right? And that means, it could mean a caring role, like a nurse or many kinds of doctors, where you have to have empathy, you have to build a relationship with a patient, or maybe in the business world where you're building very sophisticated relationships with people, understanding clients and so forth. So you want to focus on those kinds of jobs. And then the third category of jobs would be things that really require lots of dexterity and mobility in unpredictable environments, like skilled trade jobs, electricians, plumbers. I mean, it's going to be a very long time before we can build a robot that can do what a plumber does. Okay. I mean, you know, we're not even close to that. So those kinds of skilled trade jobs, which don't involve going to university, are also, you know, very good for many people. So those are the main areas I would focus on, but at all costs, avoid the kind of job where you sit in front of a computer and you do the same thing again and again, because that job is going to be gone for sure. So, you know, you want to avoid that and avoid studying for a field that will lead to that, right?
How are you personally preparing?
Well, I mean, I'm kind of fortunate is that I'm focused on being an author and a futurist, which means that the way I mostly spend my time is I think about these issues, and I go around and do a lot of speaking engagements where I get to talk about these issues and discuss them with people. And could that be automated? Maybe. I know of one guy in Japan who actually has a robot double that he can send out and the robot does speaking engagements and gives lectures and so forth. So I suppose it's susceptible, but I don't see that happening very soon. But in general, I'm prepared for disruption. I mean, I have kids. I've talked to them about this. I've got an 11-year-old daughter. We sent her to art class because we believe maybe that helps her to become more creative. And that's going to be one of the skills that will really help her to prepare for this future. But there are no easy answers. It's going to be very, very unpredictable. You know, make sure that you enjoy learning. You're prepared to continue learning. Make sure your kids enjoy learning. Try to emphasize things like creativity and building interpersonal relationships, because these are the skills that really set people apart, the things that machines can't do so easily, at least not yet. And so that's where the jobs are going to be.
I think you could always almost take it a level further, like on a meta level. Like if we take you as an example, you said the guy with the robot, but if we take you as an example, no one's going to be able to replicate the network that you've built. No one's going to be able to replicate the fame that you have and so forth, you know? These are intangible assets that you've built up, but no one can steal that or take that away from you. I think that's a good example too.
Exactly, right. And so there's an element of being kind of an entrepreneur. Maybe everyone on some level needs to be an entrepreneur. You shouldn't think, even if you are working for someone else, still think of it in a very entrepreneurial way, like you're building your career, your future, you're building a network of people that can help you, mentor you, assist you in that. And that's kind of independent of the place where you work right now. And that's something that you really need to manage in a very entrepreneurial way.
Yeah. And that's also, as you were saying in the beginning of our conversation, that's something that you really wanted for young people to get out of your new book, Architects of Intelligence, that people understand this.
Exactly. I mean, I hope it's many things. It's a chance to learn about the technology. I mean, I hope that for people that aren't familiar with AI, don't know anything about it, this is a good entry point. And furthermore, you get to learn from the smartest people in the world. It's like learning basic physics from Einstein, you know, in terms of the number of people in the book. And then you also get to hear these people discuss the issues that we need to worry about in terms of the impact that this technology is going to have on our world, on our society, on our civilization. And this is something that everyone needs to be concerned with, even if you're not technically oriented and you're not really interested in the details of the technology, you still need to be concerned about what this technology means for our way of life. And so I hope that the book will kind of fulfill a variety of roles in terms of introducing people to these topics.
Yeah, and I think it's a strategic move of you to name the book Architects of Intelligence and encouraging people to work in the area, because once the robot overlords take over, then they will hail you as like their predecessor and their maker. So that's very you shouldn't warn about them like Nick does, because you'll be the first one against the wall.
Okay. Well, I don't think I thought of it completely in those terms, but that's an interesting thought, I guess.
So you don't want to be an enemy of the CPU state. All right. And I was thinking about one more thing in that context, and that's the worst case scenario or possible worst case scenario. That's that automation continues and jobs are eliminated, but we never really get to the singularity or a total automated state, because that could actually prolong and worsen what we were discussing earlier about that 10 years from now the situation on the job market will be worse, and if it keep getting worse and if we never get to the full singularity, then it just never gets good.
Well, I'm not sure I would agree with that. I mean, the singularity, I mean, usually people associate that with the advent of superintelligence. And like I said, most people in the book, they believe that someday will happen, or at least human level intelligence, but it could be very far in the future. But even short of that, these technologies are going to bring enormous benefits. I mean, it's going to make everything more efficient. It's going to make all the stuff that we want cheaper and more available and better. We're unimaginable new products. The key challenge that I think we're going to face is distributional, right? If a lot of people lose their jobs and they can't find a foothold in the job market, then they're not going to have an income. They're not going to have a way to survive. And that's why I talk about a basic income. And maybe, as I said earlier, a basic income that has some incentives built into it to make sure that people still are motivated to do productive things. But to me, even if you don't get to the singularity, but you have very advanced forms of automation, if you combine that with a workable basic income scenario that makes sure that we have an adequate distribution of income so that people have income, and as long as we have policies in place to help people find meaning in that new world, even if they're not working as much, I think that would still be great. I mean, it's not quite the science fiction singularity thing, but it's still a world that's fantastically more abundant than the world that we have now, where we have much more wealth, much more capability, much more advanced technology, much more knowledge, much more ability to address problems like climate change. So I view that in very optimistic terms, assuming we can make the necessary adaptations. And again, that's going to include something to address income distribution, because that's, I think, the biggest single challenge that we're going to face.
Martin, it's been great talking to you. And as a final question, I wonder, where can people reach you and where should people look for your things?
The best place to look for me is on Twitter. My Twitter handle is mfordfuture. I've also got a website by the same name, mfordfuture.com, and I've got a blog there that I kind of post things in frequently. But if you go to my Twitter account, you can from there find everything about me. And every day I try to post interesting articles, you know, about artificial intelligence and robotics. So it's a good place to kind of follow along and see the latest news in terms of what's happening.
And who should read Architects of Intelligence? Who do you hope reads it and who benefits the most from reading it?
I think everyone, but certainly young people that might consider AI as a career absolutely should read it. Anyone who's a business manager or an investor that is concerned with the impact of AI on the economy or on your stock market portfolio or your investments, you should read it, because these are basically the 23 smartest people in the world, arguably, in this field. And you get to hear what they say and what they predict about the future. And then much more broadly than that, anyone at any level of society, whether you're a policymaker, a politician, or just an average person concerned about what these technologies are going to mean for the future in terms of your own life, in terms of society as a whole. So, I mean, the short answer to your question is basically everyone. Anyone that's an intelligent person that would read a nonfiction book on any subject, I mean, I think this book ought to be on your list, because it's just an incredibly important topic that is going to have a bigger impact on you and the people you care about than just about anything else, I think, over the longer term. So, you know, I'd encourage everyone to read this book.
Yeah, and I would include myself, like people like me who are young and interested in this, but maybe don't have the engineering background to know all of it, so you can learn the fundamentals. That's all we have for today. Do subscribe to our newsletter over at www.futureskillspodcast.com and you will get weekly summaries and a free ebook. As always, you can find the link to our newsletter in the bottom of the episode descriptions. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.